to Artery, with Robert Simpkins, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. In each episode of this collaborative podcast, one anthropologist, specializing in a particular cultural context, has a conversation with an artist of their choosing, exploring issues of authorship and relational creativity in art. In this special episode, and in a break from our usual format, Isa Kavedja speaks with fellow anthropologist Jonas Tinius about his research on theatre. Together they discuss how people involved in the production of theatre relate to each other, to the characters they play, and reflect upon the life of plays themselves. Jonas has just published his new book, State of the Arts, An Ethnography of German Theatre and Migration. I'll hand over to Isa to introduce her guest.
Oh, thank you so much for joining me today. It's a real pleasure to have you here in conversation. So very welcome.
Hi, Isa. It's beautiful to be on this podcast. Thank you for the invitation.
So I was wondering if we could start by telling the audience a little bit about you, about your research interests. Could you tell them something about yourself and what you've been working on?
Yes, of course. So I was trained as a social anthropologist in the department in Cambridge, and I've always had a great interest in what I guess you could call forms of cultural production, institutionalized, non-institutionalized, just the way in which we produce things that we call culture or art, something of that sort. And the reason I was interested in that was not necessarily because of things that were beautiful, but to see art and cultural production as a form of prism, as something that can open up a whole series of ways of looking at human existence and human societies. And I think I've always been particularly interested in you know, what you could call the more stable forms of human organization. So institutions, especially public institutions, theaters, museums, and then the way that that feeds back into anthropology. So that has kind of led me down the path towards the fields that I've been working on.
So tell us about the field side. Tell us where you've been working.
Yes, exactly. So for, I think it began with my early studies, actually. So already in my bachelor's and then for my PhD, I was drawn to something which you might call a sort of negative anthropology, which is, instead of going far away from home, I sort of decided to go home from a little bit further away. So I actually started doing research in an area that I come from, which is the now post-industrial Ruhr region, the Ruhrgebiet, in the west of Germany. And there in particular, I've been working with a theater, a very special one that we might be talking about a little bit more in a moment. And then once that was done with Brexit, not because of Brexit, even though that's a good enough reason, but around that time I left the UK and went to Berlin, and I started working on what you could call world museums, museums of anthropological collections in Berlin, in Italy, and in France. And that's what I'm currently writing up.
Fantastic. Thank you. And can you tell us a little bit more about your interest in theatre and how you came to be interested in it?
Yes, of course. I always think about, there's this beautiful definition that reminds me a little bit about the Levi-Straussian idea of the minimal elements of culture. And that's actually a quote by the British-born American theater critic Eric Bentley. I think it's from a book called The Life of Drama, in which he says, A impersonates B while C looks on. And he says that that's basically the most minimal definition, if we strip everything else away, of theater. And I just always was struck by that quote and by this way of looking at theater as essentially an impersonation of other people, as one human being enacting the life of another human being in front of another human being, or at least one. Because I thought that this is perhaps the most anthropological meta relation that we could imagine. And it was this kind of anthropological way of looking at theater that led me to do a little bit of research on the way in which theater has featured in anthropology, the way that performance has featured in anthropology, how it was studied, worked on, theorized. And I was just struck by the way that a lot of this research was essentially on generalized ideas of theater in as a form of cultural existence. And I was particularly interested in really professional actors and professional theater directors who every single day spend their working hours and the other hours as well thinking about how to portray human life, not on a canvas, not on a screen, but actually on a stage with real human beings. So this was kind of, I suppose, the intellectual origin of my interest in theater. But there is also, I should maybe add, and I reflect on this in my book as well, there was also a very personal element to my interest in theater, because my father was actually a high school teacher of philosophy and German literature, and he always took his students to local theaters, in particular one, instead of just teaching them the usual canon of German literature, and took them there to see how literature can enact, can be reflected upon, can be criticized, changed. And so theater for me just was a social forum, a political forum, a way to think differently about education. And I think it was probably him that took me to theater first.
Diese Bühne, wahrscheinlich ist so besonders, weil er hat eine Geschichte wieder, hat eine Vergangenheit.
That's fantastic. It's really nice to hear these stories, which are, you know, there are different ways we can tell the story of how we came to our field and how we came to our interests. It's always interesting to hear the different versions of yeah. how that came about. So that's fantastic. Mm. Thank you. And in your book, you focus on the theater under Ruhr. Could you, you know, so to speak, set the scene for us and tell us first a little bit about that institution and organization?
Yes, of course. So this was the theater that my father worked with, that he took me to, and it is in many ways an example of a city theater that you have in many different cities in Germany. I should maybe say that this is quite a specific system that that has historically emerged in Germany, partly to do with the fact that Germany has been, over its tumultuous modern history, a region of fragmented, federalized little fiefdoms and then cities and eventually countries that then became reunified. So There's been a history of decentralization and federalization and localization, I suppose, that has created a vast network of local theater, each of which is dependent on a city, is funded by a city, and therefore is to some extent relatively independent of federal, that is to say, state funding. In fact, it's quite unusual that in Germany around 80% of the funding for theater comes from cities and communities and communes, rather than from regional states or actually from the federal government. So it's quite different from, let's say, the British Council, that has a certain amount of money available that it spends on theatres. And if 1% of that gets cut, obviously a lot of theatres are affected. But in Germany, this system of financial patronage is also connected to really a political patronage, an ethical mandate, I suppose, that the German state has always had for seeing theaters as stages for a kind of moral self-formation. Of course, stages too that were used to advocate a sort of national unity. And in this particular region, this Ruhr region, in the 1980s, a time in which the creative post-industrial industries hadn't really taken off yet, there was a small group of three men, three philosophers, one dramaturg, one stage director, and one stage designer. And they decided to take over an old abandoned spa in quite a nice park, but in the industrial harbor of Mülheim an der Ruhr, in between three different cities, Oberhausen and Duisburg, all of which with a heavy industrial past. And they decided to create a little theater in that area, a little bit off the beaten tracks, not in a city center, a public-private partnership, so they would be somewhat independent of, you know, state intervention or city intervention. And what really got me so interested in them and their work is that from the very beginning, they said, we are a theater of the bastardo. We're a theater of bastards, essentially a theater for those, to explain this a little bit, that don't feel an allegiance to the state, that don't necessarily feel that they've got a mother tongue or a father country, to use the German terms. So it was a space right from the beginning, to put it differently, for refugees, but also for outsiders, for, you know, people like my father, in fact, who didn't feel proud or, you know, who couldn't relate to sentiments of nationalism and patriotism. And so they created this unusual small theater with a very closely knit ensemble. That's, I think, a very important thing to say, that they were a theater that right from the beginning had a very intimate group of people together that stayed together for almost 40 years. That's sort of the setup. There are other things that are really fascinating about this theater too, which maybe I'll just say briefly, which is that they developed right from the very beginning a sort of theater philosophy, in some ways inspired by, you know, their background in critical theory and so on, but a theater philosophy that saw theater as, you know, in an anthropological way, as one of the first arts, as an art that is about living twice, that is to say, that's about, you know, a reflection on society. And so they traveled with this theater vastly around the world and invited people from these regions, often politically precarious regions, back into this small provincial city. So it became more than a place to just enact plays.
Oh, that's a wonderful, wonderful story. It's interesting to try and imagine them in this space. Can you paint a picture for us a little bit of this location in this abandoned spa?
Yes, of course. I mean, it is strange because it's actually now, it seems rather grand. You know, this park has obviously been redone and the theater has been renovated. It's sort of a big, large, complex villa on several floors that used to be, like I said, a spa, and then it was turned into a hotel. So there are several ghosts, you know, sort of haunting this place, which is obviously a great backdrop for a theater that's very interested in, you know, the ways in which the past and the dead and all of this haunts us today. But like I said, it's also really fascinating because just a sort of a mile away from there, you've got industrially used buildings, abandoned now, one of which is actually used as a sort of extra rehearsal storage space. And this is actually also the building that's on the cover of my book, State of the Arts. And it was abandoned for a long time, and then it was used as a shelter, as a camp for refugees from the Yugoslav wars. It housed sort of a psychosocial center to offer therapy for refugees from these traumatizing wars. So it's really an area full of contradictions. And that's, I think, what makes it so fascinating. And that distance from the city also is, from the city center, is quite important, because this villa in this park next to the industrial borders with these other cities offered this particular theater this kind of space of reflection, this extraordinary setting to work away from trends and project logics and pressure of competition.
You mentioned your book, this State of the Arts, an Ethnography of German Theater and Migration. And in it, you describe the rehearsal process as one of the central processes that takes place. And so I was wondering if you could kind of give us an example, maybe a vignette, so that we can imagine this rehearsal as a form of working.
Yes, absolutely. That's such a central point to this book and to my work, which again came about through anthropological fieldwork, because I didn't come to this theater thinking I was going to write about rehearsal, or thinking that rehearsals would be such a central and fundamental practice. But as I spent time, because I spent over 18 months, I suppose, for my PhD, but years before, in some ways, getting to know this theater and working with it after too, I just realized that most of the time and most of the conversations revolved around an extended idea of rehearsal, an extended idea of rehearsals as a multi-layered process towards developing certain capacities, certain forms of conduct, that in this book I theorize using a term from the field, from this ensemble, which is Haltung, a German term that has been used by Brecht, but actually means, you know, a mix of posture, comportment, conduct. So bringing together the way in which you hold yourself, the way in which you view yourself, your attitude towards the world, your political opinions, and so on. And it just became really obvious to me that, you know, rehearsals were actually almost more important than the plays. And I say this because the plays that eventually you would see on a stage were showing you were the results of a collective process of working towards understanding what is behind the play. So working towards understanding a certain relationship to the world or a certain attitude towards the world that is being looked at. And so more concretely speaking, rehearsals usually would begin with a certain kind of idea for a play. Somebody might bring in, you know, a manuscript or a certain moment, a certain event might trigger an interest in a particular play or a text or a film. And then the entire house, in fact, would get together into what was called Konzeptionsgespräche, which is a word that you could translate as sort of conceptual discussions. And these conceptual discussions would basically begin in the foyer with the ensemble sitting around a large table and the dramaturg and the director discussing just essentially what this play could and should be about. And the interesting thing that I noticed right from the very beginning was that the books themselves, the dramas, the plays, really played not the most central role. Later on, I understood that this whole way of directing is called post-dramatic theater, which obviously makes sense because it was drawing on other resources as well. But it became, I think I understood what Roberto Ciulli, the director of this theater, meant when he said that in theater, you always have four authors. The first one being the playwright, the second being the director and his whole staff of artists, which could involve dramaturgs, stage designers, and so on. The third author is the actor, the actress, and now there's an interesting German word that Ciulli and this ensemble always use, which is Handlung, die Handelnde, which literally means something like somebody who's acting, who's enacting something. So the actor and the actress is the third author. And the fourth, of course, is the audience. And it's exactly for that reason that, you know, whenever there would be an audience discussion and people would ask, what did you intend with this play? You know, what did you try to tell us? Ciulli would usually reply and say, what did you see? And in that way, refusing not only over-explanation and a certain kind of pedagogical attitude towards theater, but really underlying this point that it's an offer. You know, these are images. And every visitor is a sort of archive, a sort of theater repertoire onto themselves that comes and encounters another one. And that's also why, generally speaking, rehearsals at this theater would sometimes take 8 months. And there might only be two plays over a year that they would work on and rehearse. And this would really allow this whole, you know, ensemble to get together and develop a certain, I suppose, capacity to become otherwise. And because you were asking for a specific example, I was actually thinking I do discuss in the book one of many different rehearsals. And the one that I discuss is actually a rehearsal from the play, or off the play, Long Day's Journey into Night, which is a Pulitzer Prize winning drama by Eugene O'Neill. Which in this case is actually not so important, because like I said, I'm trying to make a point in this book about rehearsals as a practice independent of particular plays. But what was interesting about this play in particular was that the play was about a certain kind of eerie in-between stage between life and death, depicting people suffering from alcoholism and apathy towards one another. And so the actors were supposed to, I suppose, embody a certain kind of disinterest for one another. And just how to rehearse that you're both in a play, acting in a play, and at the same time, not really present, became a really interesting example in this process. But there are many more that I could tell you, so I'll stop here.
Tell us more about this one. I'd love to hear the way this played out. What were the initial suggestions, how to embody this, and what were some responses from different people involved? Can you tell us about that?
Well, this is interesting, because the rehearsals that would often take place in this formerly industrial building that I just mentioned, that used to house this refugee shelter in the 80s. So we would often sit there and sort of in the cold, everybody wearing jackets on, cheap chairs, people smoking, sort of before the actual stage, right? Before the rehearsal stage. Because that very process of discussing, of trying to understand how to relate to a character and not to become that character, but to reflect on the affordance and the complexities of what an action on stage is supposed to or could say. And so we would often sit there in trying to understand how you could express, as it were, apathy, for instance, how you could express a certain kind of ghost-like eeriness. And truly the director and the dramaturg would often, make this very interesting and I think very important distinction between the images that we create for an audience, that is to say, the things that people see or hear, and the images, the internal images, that is to say, what the actor and the actress have worked on themselves, what their attitude towards a character is, and the way in which they can enact something, the way in which they might want to distance themselves from a character. So I think that's really important, to not confuse these two, and to not let people, to not give away immediately things and make an appearance. For example, the clothes that people were wearing, which were discussed at great length with the costume designer who created these clothes that she bathed in water, where she had dissolved some rusty iron nails, so that basically they had this patina of decay and decadence.
That's interesting. I recall also that you, if I'm not wrong, described the situation where they're trying to think about what it would be like to embody a disposition of not being quite alive, what it would be to act as if you were dead. And I thought it was a really interesting point. And so am I right in thinking that the actress was wondering how to do this in a visceral way, how to do this with the body, and what were the conversations that ensued around that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, of course, I remember one particular scene actually where an actor was on stage, and he was, as he was a young actor who had just joined the ensemble. And I suppose you could sort of tell that he'd just come out of acting school. So he was very concerned with speaking very clearly and articulating his emotions and sort of exaggerating his gestures, because of course, it's very different when you're sitting on a small rehearsal stage where, you know, you would have the stage set sometimes already built, and then just a couple of sort of stamina room tables, you know, makeshift things almost on stage where the director and his assistants and the dramaturgs would sit, and then behind us or behind them, you know, usually the anthropologist and other people. So you'd be quite intimate. And to learn how to then shift on a stage where you might be talking in front of 1,000 people is a very different physical exercise. And there was a moment in which this young actor was sort of in some way speaking as if he was already on a large stage. And, you know, Julie interrupted him and said, listen, you're speaking as if you really mean it. And in this case, you know, you're embodying something who has such a disinterest in the other person in front of them, who's in a strange liminal in-betweenness. We don't really want to tell the audience whether this is already a situation in heaven, whether these people are in hell, whether these people have already died or not, or whether it's a sort of delirious in-between stage. And, you know, and these are processes in which you realize that people draw both on their physical trained capacities, I suppose, you know, Bourdieu's habitus, but these people are trained, but they also have to draw on, you know, on other things. They have to work with the stage design, which was, as I said, a kind of co-author in these plays. And so this was very interesting to me to understand that it wasn't just about being incredibly clear or telling a story for an audience, but truly constantly trying to interrupt in a way and get people to think for themselves and not just to be the character that they were enacting. So it was a complicated process that really was teaching them something about, you know, what I call the conduct of conduct. And that obviously goes way beyond a particular play.
So what is conduct of conduct? Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, so conduct of conduct for me was a way of trying to understand the way in which you can develop, you know, this capacity to become different. And I realized after a while that there was something interesting about this for me, because it was a capacity that we also see beyond theater. That is to say, we as human beings are constantly telling stories through the way in which we dress, we speak, we educate ourselves, the people we relate to, and so on. So we're constantly involved in a process of narration of ourselves, which of course, as we know through the amazing work of Cheryl Mattingly and others, is in fact, you know, also a therapeutic process. Narratives and stories are very much used to understand ourselves, to better ourselves, to work on certain things. But very often that is done with view to the idea of an inner self, that is to say, a true self that we have to discover, that we have to become, ideas of integrity, for instance, you know, alienation and so on. The idea is always, or at least it seems, that we could somehow arrive at being more within ourselves and with ourselves. And by observing these actors, I sort of began to realize that maybe that's the wrong way of looking at things. And maybe we should actually understand that fiction and the becoming otherwise or becoming different or being multiple things at the same time is perhaps much more true in some ways to how human beings are. You know, fiction is central to, in inverted commas, reality. And so that realization led me to look at this theater very differently, to understand, as these actors were saying too, that what they're doing on stage is not an as if. They are there on stage. They're using their bodies. They're making use of real time. 5 minutes on stage or 5 minutes for these actors' bodies, even though you might say to the audience that these 5 minutes were 5,000 years. And so there is both a lot of fiction and reality and a lot of realness in this supposed fiction on stage. So, yeah.
That's a fascinating idea. I really like this idea of kind of becoming otherwise. And it's interesting in relation to narratives and stories we tell ourselves. They're probably many stories that entrap us, that don't serve us particularly well. And so to be able to step out of them seems it would be particularly freeing. Do you think that was one of the reasons why this was so attractive to some of the people who felt marginal in the society? Do you think that was partly what drew them to this project?
That's a very interesting question. And I think I would have to answer this with, you know, with reference to different episodes over the history of this theater, maybe, and then I'll say something more general. I think at the very beginning, when this theater started in the 80s and well into the 90s, you know, there was a fixation on identity and language in theater that was very oppressive. And in fact, I traced a lot of this for a kind of strange, excessive book that I ended up doing just before this book got published, on this theater and on this very charismatic authority, Roberto Ciulli. It's a book in which we traced all kinds of documents and newspaper reviews that hadn't been published or put together. And, you know, we transcribed sort of cassettes, sort of diaries that he had spoken onto cassettes and taped and so on.
Ich kann mir nicht hier im Moment den Eindruck, dass wir nach dem Tod geworden am Ende sind. Eigentlich kann man nicht ohne eine Unterbrechung, ohne eine Zeit des Schweigens wieder sofort anzufangen.
So looked at a lot of material, and it became clear that when Ciulli, who was Italian and who's, you know, very eloquent in his own ways, started out this theater and obviously engaged with German literature and German plays, there was a xenophobic backlash from critics, major critics, major newspapers, not just, you know, conservative ones, telling him he should stick to Italian plays, you know, and how dare he do these plays, you know, by German writers, especially with some of the actors and actresses that he had hired right at the beginning. One, a very famous one who sadly passed away very, very young due to cancer, Gordana Kozanovic, who right at the beginning could barely speak German. And he put her on stage and said, "This is your way, appropriate this play. You know, make it yours and bring it back and start a sort of metabolism, because this is exactly what we see in society. You know, this is how cultures develop. This is, I suppose, what it means to say we're, you know, Germany's a migrant society or even a post-migrant society in which, you know, a certain reified culture idea about Germanness and German literature then gets taken on and reworked. So this is one aspect, but I wanted to say something else, which is much more related to the time in which I conducted my fieldwork. Because around 2013, 14, when I really seriously worked in this theater, Germany had just publicly negotiated and discussed, you know, the Lampedusa boat tragedy and the beginning of another influx of migration across the Mediterranean, which then, of course, culminated in the so-called long summer of migration, 2015, 16, and various other waves since then. And what I observed was that across Germany, public theaters, who've always had this public mandate of engaging with society, started creating initiatives for refugees and, you know, in inverted commas, newcomers, others, non-Germans, and so on. And in a lot of these plays, which you could call documentary plays or, verbatim theater and so on. And in a lot of these plays, the people on stage, those that were non-German, were invited, we could say, encouraged, I would actually say almost expected, to play themselves. That is to say, they were not afforded the luxury of fiction. And what emerged was a whole series of theater plays, almost the whole aesthetic, I think, that emerged really beyond Germany too, of a sort of double authentication where somebody who was already on stage but had to play themselves with their own names, with their own stories. And so this was, I think, another reason why people became attracted to come and engage with the Theater an der Ruhr, because there, you know, the ensemble had a different view that said, no, actually, the real political gesture rests in showing yourself to be capable of becoming, as you said, otherwise.
It's interesting to think about the kind of various forms of collaboration in the theater setting. So to invite people to participate is one, but how one does that, it really matters. Did you want to tell us a little bit more about one of those kind of collaborative plays that the new director of the theater, Adam, was devising when he was working on Ruhr Orter? Is there something you wanted to add about that?
Happily, yes, happily. I mean, Adam Köstereli, who was actually a young actor in the so-called youth theater of the Theater an der Ruhr, almost two decades back, he left the theater for a long time because he didn't want to be involved in this whole competitive project-based art logic, but always produced plays under the aegis of the Theater an der Ruhr, truly has this whole, he's a very interesting person because, you know, he's now almost 90, but he's got this whole series of, I suppose he sometimes says it provocatively, you know, sleepers, intellectuals, people like Navid Kermani and others who, not just in Germany, but also elsewhere, have somehow at some point been associated with this theater and have now gone elsewhere and take this kind of philosophy a little bit further. And Adam was one of these people who came back and in 2013-14 founded actually a small theater group that was called Ruhrorter. And this theater group began rehearsing, began working with local refugee camps in the different cities. You know, you really have to imagine, I mean, this is a very specific urban context. Duisburg and Oberhausen are both cities of, you know, 400,000 people. Mülheim has 200,000 people, and they're all kind of interwoven. It's really an urban fabric of 50 cities in general that are right next to one another. And each of these has a different policy towards the housing of refugees. And some of these were just so horrendous, you know. And Adam was a very interesting character because everybody knew him in the city. He was, you know, he roamed in between the different spheres from the shisha bars that I described, you know, to the management of companies and the theater world. And so I witnessed and kind of, in some ways, I suppose, collaboratively worked as an anthropologist observing, but also sometimes as a dramaturg, you know, co-writing also applications and writing in the papers about them and so on. This group called Ruhrorter, which is in reference to the very street and this industrial harbor called Ruhrort, which literally means places along the Ruhr, this river. And he developed a very specific method, I suppose, not one that is just based on one way of behaving, but he had this very strongly refused, like I was just outlining, this idea that people would really have to perform themselves, not only because he said that this is a very dangerous practice, actually, because a lot of theater directors are not trained as therapists or as psychologists. And once you dig into these deeply personal narratives and feelings of trauma, or once you, you know, theater is about life. So essentially, could any kind of emotional setting could come up, could trigger something, could trigger a breakdown or an emotional revisiting of trauma. And he always said that this is, you know, theater is not trained for this. We should also really be realistic. You know, artists and cultural producers are often not trained to deal with these difficult emotions. And so he developed, I suppose, safety mechanisms and complex methods in which, for instance, because he was always writing his own plays together with this group of migrants and refugees. And they would start working, for instance, on figures. You know, let's say the relationship between a mother and her daughter. Very basic, beautiful, archetypal sort of elements of life that he used to construct his plays. And he would, in improvisation, sometimes just ask people to, you know, tell a story, some memory of their mother and or their sister and her relationship to her mother. And sometimes he would ask people to write them down in whatever language they spoke. It wouldn't matter if others would understand it. And then he might ask them to share that story. So maybe somebody who wrote a story in Persian would share it with another person in the group who might know Persian, which often was the case, or in Turkish or in a Serbo-Croatian language. And then that other person would take this very personal story and read it out aloud, thus alienating in some ways himself or herself and the other person from that story, and creating what I described as a sort of a rehearsed detachment. And then there would be other processes. There might be a moment in which he would ask somebody else yet to walk around the room reading this story, loudly, quietly, shouting, running, to a point where this story would almost become so detached from anyone in particular that then the group could work with elements of it without being, as it were, so personally attached to it, allowing them a different way of engaging with these very fundamental types of stories. And there are many different ways in which he did that, you know, using both communicative, vocal, emotional, physical ways of relating. This is just one example, but it really struck me that that was a different way of engaging with fiction and the reappropriation of it too.
Aber weißt du, wie lange eine Minute ist?
Wedekind, Lulu. Woody Allen, Gott. Shakespeare, ein Sommernachtstraum. Peter Weiss, ein neuer Prozess. Sophocles, Elektra. Tschechow, die Möwe. Ruzante, la Moschetta. Molière, Tartuffe. Horvath, Casimir und Caroline. Beckett, Glückliche Tage. Büchner, Dantons Tod. Sartre, Tod unbegrifflich. Schneider, die kroatische Faust. Antke Kastner. Brecht, drei große Oper. Euripides, die Backen. Wieder Beckett, Warten auf Godot. Kleist, das Kätzchen von Heilbronn. Büchner, Leons und Lena. Roberto Ciulli.
It's fantastic, this idea of detaching stories. It really reminds me of another point I wanted to touch upon, which was, I guess, to the extent that plays also might acquire a life of their own when they're performed. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed the chapter of your book on the repertoire, and the way that actors and artists remain engaged with particular plays for a really long time, but they also travel with this place to different places, as you said, including some places of political censorship or unrest. And so I was wondering, you know, the in those places they're perceived and experienced quite differently. So could we maybe say that the plays do are become in some way detached or acquire a life of their own?
Yes, I think that is one way one could put it. And I'm trying to think where to begin, because I should maybe, you know, contextualize again that this theater that I work with, which of course I'm using as a case study on the one hand, but also to talk about much broader ideas about, you know, ethics and the state and art and anthropology and so on. But this theater has existed now for 45 years almost. And the fascinating thing is that the director, the dramaturg, of course, you can imagine several people passed away tragically over these 45 years, including the founding stage designer. But many in this ensemble have stayed together, working in the same space, working sometimes on the same plays, which is what this repertoire refers to, this word. It's a very specific, it's somewhat specific to the German theater system, but it really, as Diana Taylor also elaborates, it really just also means having something that you can go back to, refer back to, a repertoire of ideas or comportments, you know, conduct that I describe. And so some of the plays that this theater had devised in the 80s were in this repertoire and were being restaged. And you can just already begin to imagine how it must be for an actress to play the same play, the same in inverted commas character for 20 years, for 30 years. You know, not only your body changes, the political situation changes, the audiences change, your relationship to the other people change. You know, sometimes if the playwrights are still alive, their attitude towards plays might change. So this is only one aspect. The second aspect that I think is really fascinating, and I mentioned this, is that right from the very beginning, the Theater an der Ruhr developed what is called the International Theater Landscapes Project. And the International Theater Landscapes Project basically was an attempt to create political, diplomatic, intellectual, artistic relations with, you know, what you could call, I guess, politically precarious parts of the world, not via official public channels and institutions, but actually through theaters. So, for instance, the Theater an der Ruhr became the first Western theater to start working with Iran after the revolution. It has since been invited many times to the so-called Fajr Festival in Tehran, initiated exchanges with actors and dramaturgs to and from Tehran and Mülheim. It worked with Kazakhstan, with Yugoslavia right after the wars, with Russia right after the fall of the Iron Curtain. Of course, with theaters in, you know, the Arab-speaking world right after the, you know, the so-called Arab Spring. And there was one particular, actually, endeavor that the Theater an der Ruhr begun, and I think this is perhaps the most apt description of what you just mentioned, which is that beginning in 2001, they initiated a project that actually was never fully realized, but that doesn't really matter so much. I found that out in the archives later. Their idea was to take, you know, the theme of Faust and to travel with this, with three different Faust productions, essentially along the old Silk Road, from the you know, Mediterranean all the way to China, including Iran. And they began many of these projects, not in one go, you know, not in this sort of in a romanticized caravan or something of that sort, but of course, you know, step by step, twice every year, traveling to one place, coming back, then going further. And their idea was that over time, the productions that they would show would actually take on elements of, let's say, censorship in a certain place where women couldn't touch or actors couldn't touch. So they would have to hold, as in one case, a piece of cloth to symbolize connection, for instance, or nudity that can't be shown. And, you know, incorporating these different changes to create a sort of, you know, I suppose, post-universal Faustian production. That never fully happened, but the process, I think, is exactly an attempt to do just what you said, you know, to include all the different authors not just the playwrights, but the audiences and the political context, and to recognize that that is, that there are so many different authors that produce this art core theater.
Oh, thank you. That's so interesting. It makes me also think about the role that the anthropologist plays. So, you know, in the way we conduct our fieldwork, we're very much reliant on people who we encounter in the field, on our interlocutors or on our friends in the field. And really, you know, the very project of anthropology is in some ways collaborative. So I was wondering if you could reflect on that. But also, I recall that you wrote in your book that, in another text, if I'm not wrong, that increasingly anthropologists are invited to view their fieldwork on art as a form of collaboration. Who is inviting anthropologists, and what does it particularly mean that we are conducting fieldwork on art? What could anthropologists' role be seen to be in these kinds of settings?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very true. This is, I set out to thinking that I could maybe do a somewhat of a traditional ethnography, you know, going into a field and understanding the particular practices. And very soon you realize that, as James Clifford puts it, objectivity is always, you know, there's always a partiality, a situatedness to our research that cannot be written away. And if we do, then that's just a certain form of ethnographic holism. It's just a rhetoric that we try. My presence in this field and my reflection on the co-production, in fact, my invitation to join the founding of this theater and research group, really, you know, triggered a whole series of reflections. I was a research student then, and I was still concerned with, I suppose, influencing or co-writing or co-producing elements, until I understood that, as George Marcus and Nikolai Soronchakov and many other people have really written, we are constantly, you know, it's sort of the ripple effect. You know, if we drop a pebble in a calm lake and then we observe what happens, this is sort of how I felt my presence was, you know. Even though the fields we enter are never calm lakes, I think that's a bit of an idealized image that sometimes circulates, but we enter a field and our presence has ripple effects, has consequences. And to actually own that, to recognize that, allows a much richer experience of a field, because it shows us the ways in which we have to adapt, the ways in which our presence provokes certain reactions. You know, but more specifically in the relating to art, I think I was just observing, following, of course, an engagement with relational aesthetics and the workings of the writings of Hal Foster, who already in the 90s wrote about the collaborations between artists and anthropologists. I was really struck, especially having finished my work on theater and having started to work on curatorial field, contemporary art, and museums, I realized that more and more anthropological themes, theories were incorporated into exhibitions, were incorporated by curators to often criticize them, but use them, rework them. And I found that just such a fascinating new phase of engagement that didn't so much have to do with us going into a field and offering a theory, but those fields actually being themselves already so reflexive, often in my fieldwork, so professional, so intellectual, so institutionalized, drawing on their own traditions, you know, not living in a flat contemporariness, but actually drawing on, especially in the field of contemporary modern art, drawing on long traditions of anti-art and post-art and post-autonomous and whatever art fields and traditions and theories, that they saw what we do essentially as just another field that they can engage with. And I think that was a very healthy reassessment of our role, because often as anthropologists, I observe we tend to move into a sphere and somehow assume that that field would just be open to us, that it's fine and possible to go almost everywhere in the world. And I think that's not the case. I think collaboration, as I've written elsewhere, and as is so fundamental to me, is a complex process in which we can take many different roles, and they don't always have to be the same. You know, I spoke of it sometimes in my work with curators in Berlin as a sort of sparring partnership. You know, using drawing a little bit on Louis Wacon's work. You know, on boxers who train themselves without wanting to injure themselves, you know, who are just making each other more aware of possible movements and so on. And I found that to be a slightly more honest way of engaging with this relationship, because I don't want to idealize, you know, what art is, what anthropology is, and assume that we speak the same language, even though there are many artists that are anthropologists and vice versa, but to recognize the importance of that difference sometimes, you know, different positionalities and competencies.
Oh, that's so interesting. To end on that note, to think a little bit about the more gently adversarial forms of collaboration, yes, that we, yes, really don't tend to reflect on as much. That is wonderful. Thank you so much, Jonas. This was a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for this invitation. It was a pleasure talking to you.
This was Artery with Robert Simpkins, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology, supported by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council. Hope to speak with you again soon.